오빤 강남 스타일. 강남 스타일. 오빤 강남 스타일. 강남 스타일. 오빤 강남 스타일.
Yes, people all over Australia are dancing Psy's Gangnam Style, one of South Korea's most popular exports. Over the last 50 years, South Korea has risen from being, well, you'd have to say a pretty poor country, to being the rather more prosperous home of big corporations like Samsung and Hyundai and LG. And along with this rise is the increasing dominance of South Korea in pop culture. Gangnam Style is just one example. Perhaps you're eating more kimchi than you used to. In fact, Yuni Hong attributes the new Korean wave, the new Korean success, to the rise of pop culture exports. She moved to South Korea from America as a teenager. Yuni's now back in the USA, and she's documented South Korea's transformation in a terrific book. It's called The Birth of Korean Cool, and she joins us now from a studio somewhere in the beautiful but stormy city of Boston. Good morning to you, Yuni.
Good morning.
Nice to have you with us. So just tell us a little about your own story. At 12, your family moved to South Korea, and I gather you actually grew up in Gangnam. What is Gangnam? Where's Gangnam?
Gangnam is actually the poshest district of Seoul. It's the area that Psy is mocking in his song Gangnam Style. Literally just means south of the river. It's synonymous with new money.
All right. So it's Beverly Hills.
Yes, slightly dingier, but yeah, the same sort of retail vibe. Yes, definitely.
The same sort of aspirations, maybe.
Yes, exactly. You know, if there were diamond dog collars in Seoul, that's they would be in Gangnam. Absolutely.
Okay. So you had to navigate. I don't know how to say these words. Nunchi, is that the word I'm looking for?
Nunchi, yes. One of the hardest things about adjusting to Korean life, and I should say that I was actually born in the U.S. My family did a reverse immigration. And then we moved to Seoul, as you mentioned, when I was 12, to Gangnam. Nunchi is one of the most subtle aspects of Korean culture, but it's probably the most important. And it basically means keeping your wits about you or situation awareness. And it means that every time you enter a room, you have to kind of do, it's kind of like Terminator. You have to sort of assess who's in the room, how old they are, whether they're your superior or inferior in social standing. And this determines literally the words that you use, whether you use honorific language or not,
wow,
how you behave, the kinds of things you can say, where you can sit, how you can sit, you know, whether you can accept tea if offered, how long you should stay, whether you leave the room facing, sort of retreating like a page boy, or whether you're allowed to show your back.
Stop, it's a nightmare. It's a nightmare. I'm having brain overload. I realize I just stumble into rooms and let whatever happens happen. I'd be a sitting duck.
Yes, I mean, a lot of faux pas start with a lack of nunchi, absolutely.
Yeah, no, I've never had any nunchi, I see now. That's where my life went completely wrong, a lack of the nunchi factor. All right, so now I gather that the South Korea of your youth was without the irony that we associate with that song, with Gangnam Style, because that's all, it's all tongue-in-cheek, it's all laughing. But this is a much more serious notion of culture that you're describing.
Yes, well, I can say with absolute confidence that South Korea had no irony while I was living there. And I would say this because irony is the byproduct of prosperity. All, you know, everyone from Aristophanes to Oscar Wilde wrote at the height of the wealth of their particular country, and Psy is no different. When Korea was an underdeveloped country, and let's not forget that after the Korean War in the 50s, it was actually poorer than sub-Saharan Africa. It was one of the poorest nations in the world. And it's not really fitting to be a satirist when there are starving people who don't have indoor plumbing.
This is a fantastic concept. The idea that irony is the privilege of the rich. Show me an ironic peasant and I will show you a prince who's gone undercover.
I like that. I like that a lot. That's very quotable.
Well, thank you very much. It was inspired by you, I have to say, on the spur of the moment. So, okay, so here we have Korea suddenly emerging as this sort of funky country, exporting what is often called soft power. How did this come about? Is this an accident or is this all part of some grand plan?
I think the sort of secret hidden in plain sight is that everything that you're seeing, the sudden explosion of not only Korean pop, but Korean dramas, Korean films, Korean food even, it's not an accident that it's Storm of the World right now. This is the result of 15 to 20 years of government government intervention. They've been funding the export of pop culture since the late 90s, and with the cooperation of the private sector, of course. But I like to say Korea is the only capitalist liberal democracy in the world that can, when necessary, act as a command economy, which is to say that the government can tell Hyundai, Samsung, and so forth what to do. And the result is what we see now, which everyone assumes that they discovered on their own because they have cool, interesting, hip friends who listen to K-pop.
Right, so it's actually all part of a cunning marketing plan conceived by the bureaucracies within the Korean government. And it's an extraordinary idea because we think of pop culture as the very area of culture that is taken care of by the market. You know, the high arts, yes, they may need all sorts of government funding or private philanthropy, but pop culture, it'll run itself. That's a product. So the idea that the government would sit down and say, okay, we're going to create a pop culture industry and then export that culture to the world, the hard heads of Western economic theory would say that can't work.
Well, yes, and South Korea is actually the first country in the world that actually attempts to dethrone America as the world's top exporter of popular culture. And South Koreans are very stubborn, and they've always had the export model that if we create the supply, the demand will appear. You know, if we build it, they will come.
They will
and
come.
So forth.
It's a shame it's an American line you have to use in order to explain a Korean philosophy. Well, but there you go. We live in a globalized world. So how did they do this? I mean, what I suppose the question is, what did they get right?
Well, a couple of things. One is they bet on the internet really early. In the late 90s, Korea realized that this World Wide Web was still new and no country had an obvious advantage. So the Korean president at the time decided Korea is going to be the number one wired country in the world with 100% internet penetration for every citizen of this country. He didn't want to wait for the free market for, you know, for people to go, oh, this internet thing sounds good. That would have taken 5 or 10 years. He wanted it right away. And because of the rise of the internet, Korean entertainment was able to send out, diffuse pop song videos and dramas. This is key. This requires high bandwidth. And that's kind of why the K-pop revolution worldwide only became really, really obvious in the West about, say, 2006, 2007, because that's how long it took for Western countries to catch up technologically, that they could have enough broadband to watch Korean dramas and K-pop and so forth.
You know, you also need talent. You need the people who can do this stuff. Are they being trained? How is all that working?
Right. Well, that's a second part of the formula is the stereotypical Korean student life where you kind of don't really have a life from childhood works very well for the K-pop star making system. Because Korea had never had a cottage industry of homegrown talent, they don't have people strumming guitars in cafes hoping to be discovered. And there wasn't time for that. Korea didn't want to wait for, you know, John Lennon and Paul McCartney to accidentally meet. That was a one in a trillion chance that that even happened. So everything had to be manufactured. And so the way that the K-pop recruitment system works is that they find kids when they're pretty much 12 years old. It's kind of like a Romanian gymnast life. They have strict rules. They're not allowed to date. They're taught etiquette. Very strict etiquette. They're told what to say. They're told how to dress. Their weight is carefully controlled. And most importantly, they are not allowed to perform in public for years and only with the bands to which they're signed. And because they're signed on so young and because the bands are formed years before they're even allowed to perform, this allows them to perfect not only the harmony, but the dance. And what most people don't realize that they're so mesmerized by in a K-pop video is that everyone is dancing in a very synchronized kind of clockwork kind of way. And as a Korean record executive said to me, well, you know, if you look at an American music video like NSYNC or Boyz II Men, they dance okay, but not well together.
Well, and they're dancing. We'll just hear some of the sounds. They're dancing to music like this.
Next.
Yes, it's crying out for precision dancing, that one. That's called I'm the Best by 2NEI. Is it NEI or 2NEI?
Popular 2NE1.
2NE1. See, I'm so uncool, I don't know. 2NE1, the popular South Korean girls band. So in Paris, there was one concert date scheduled for a 6,000-seat arena called Le Zenith, or Le Zenith, right. I guess it was in Paris, that featured right. K-pop super elite groups. There were several of them. And tell us what happened.
Well, I was actually in France at the time, living there. They sold out their tickets in 15 minutes. Which they weren't expecting. Le Zénith is a huge amphitheater. It's where like all the big bands go. And so they weren't expecting this at all, but there was only one concert date planned. So there was an 11-city simultaneous flash mob all throughout France with young people demanding a second concert date. So a second concert date was created. But this is like a sort of genius example of Korean marketing. The flash mobs were not spontaneous either. They were kind of orchestrated and tipped off. Yeah, they were orchestrated and tipped off by a sort of obscure government employee who working in France at the Korean Ministry, the Korean Cultural Center. But, you know, you can't say it doesn't work. It does work. And I'm actually glad you picked that particular song.
Shocking. So there's this Korean with lots of nunchi who knows exactly mm-hmm. when he walks into the space, which is Paris, how the French will behave. After all, they have this revolutionary tradition. And he says, we can use this.
That's exactly right. I know you're kidding, but that's exactly how Koreans approach marketing. They study the history of the country they're approaching, and they kind of become whatever you need them to be.
Right. I wonder whether they'll master Australian informality. You know, we're very informal. We're very casual. Can the Koreans get their head around that? Are we the final frontier?
They might have to switch from soju to beer.
Oh, yeah, they might do that. We're not all beer-swilling. Although I have been enjoying a beer recently, and I was in Kalgoorlie recently where it was very hot, and the beer was a lovely thing. What about holograms? How do they come into South Korea's vision of the future?
Well, yes, I mean, holograms are an example of the kind of thing that Korean pop cultural money is going toward. I mean, the government has marshaled literally billions of dollars toward research. And they do things that would not happen in any other country, really. One is that they fund scientific research for things like hologram creation for entertainment purposes. So let's say, for example, a 2NE1 wants to perform at every, you know, they can perform in every single city in the world simultaneously. And in theory, if the hologram is well created, you should not be able to tell which is the real one. Of course, holograms exist now. I mean, P. Diddy did a hologram appearance at some awards show, but that's a bad hologram. You can only see if you're fully facing front of the P. Diddy image. If you're sitting at the side, you just see flashes of light. The Koreans are working on a realistic 3D hologram where it actually looks like the person is there. So if you look at them from the back, you see the back of their head rather than just a reverse mirror image of the front. You know, and so this is what they're doing instead of developing, you know, space-age weaponry, which they're not really allowed to do because
well,
of
that,
the relationship with
now
America.
Now, that puts it in a nice context. He said, I was thinking it was a bit insidious, all this hologram entertainment, but if the alternative is inventing missiles, of course, video pop stars that are holograms, that's a formula for world peace and eternal happiness, and the planet will be dancing. Yes, it sounds like a good thing after all. Uni, thank you for joining us. It's been great to talk to you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.